You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, Roughneck Scarves, and Golden Goal Press. It is Tuesday, July 9th, 2019. Happy belated 4th of July. And we've got a great show for you tonight, talking all things about the Women's World Cup Final and Super Soccer Sunday, including the Gold Cup Final as well. But first, let me introduce my co-host for this evening, Rachel McCrigger. Rachel, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
Well, I mean, we're World Cup champions. We'll get to that, I'm sure. But I feel great. I'm going to be feeling great for the next 4 years. And I'm going to laugh profusely and celebrate with the United States while they chug their Budweiser in New York City.
very well said. So I guess on that note, let's get to it, Rachel. Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time at the National Stadium in Paris, France. The United States women's national team took on the Netherlands, and they were victorious, winning their fourth ever World Cup by a score of 2-0. Megan Rapinoe on a penalty in the 61st minute, off of one Alex Morgan, getting a pretty nice bruise for a kick up near the arm, I would say the upper abdomen area. And then Rose Lavelle going almost full Diego Maradona in the 69th minute to score to make it 2-0. Your general thoughts on the match, and you know, the women adding a 4-star to the crest?
I mean, it was a really entertaining game. I'm happy with how it all played out. I think it was great from start to finish. You know, everyone was getting worried for the first half. Why hasn't the United States scored? Well, I mean, that's what happens when you underestimate a good team like the Netherlands. Hats off to them. I mean, they debuted in 2015 and they came back in 2019 to go all the way to the final. So great job by them. But I mean, the United States, their level is just up to here. It's just better than the rest of the world. And right now they're proving that left and right. There was a lot of questions coming into this tournament. Don't know if all of them were answered, but at least they were all put to rest for the time being. And you know that now they're hungrier than ever to silence the critics and go for that Olympic title too, to make a little bit of history.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that'll be, correct me if I'm wrong, Rachel, but in the history of the women's game, there, no World Cup winner has gone on the next summer to win the Olympic gold medal, correct?
You would be correct.
Oh, look at me actually knowing some of my stats about women's soccer. No, I agree with you, Rachel. I think it was a fairly cagey first 30 minutes or so. I think some people, were overreacting in terms of, oh God, the U.S. women's national team didn't score in the first 15 minutes. What does this mean for the game and everything? But they still mostly had the game under control and they had more of the chances. And on the whole, I think the better of the chances. I think the Dutch got a few things wrong tactically. And, you know, I know we've talked off and on about the starting decisions and some of the substitution moves that Jill Ellis has made. But for the most part, she's had things pretty down pat, that once they get to the point that they're in a comfortable position, Julie Ertz drops back into, a center back role, and then, you know, they have substitutions and other moves that end up working things out. It's really just about them finding that first goal. But there was never any point up until that first goal for me in the 61st minute that I didn't feel like the U.S. didn't have the game under control, that I didn't feel like from either a stat standpoint or from a visual perspective, just watching the game and the narrative behind it, that the U.S. were the better team in both of those marks. And I think it was just really inevitable of, could Netherlands find one moment of brilliance before the U.S. could, or, you know, would eventually the U.S. just be able to win the game and really shut the game down? And they got that in the 61st minute. You know, I know there was a little bit of a concern with Kelly O'Hara living, you know, in the at the end of the first half, you know, getting subbed out for Ali Krieger, you know, for, you know, a suspected, I don't know if we've gotten any confirmation on that Rachel, but there were concussion-like symptoms, whether or not she actually had a concussion, but she was on the bench in the second half, and from what I saw celebrating with the team from the various now-deleted Instagram videos of that sequence. But really, other than that, like, there wasn't a whole lot of concerns for me. It was just, does the U.S. get the first goal, and are they able to shut things down? And they got that in the 64th minute. They were looking for maybe a moment of brilliance in order to really get the game under control, and that came from Rose Lavelle, of all people, who I thought had arguably the best game for her in the entire tournament. I would say this midfield three had the best game of their tournament overall, with Julie Ertz in the middle, Samantha Mewis, who I've had some doubts about, and you know, Rose Lavelle, who's been good but who's also been inconsistent. She was fantastic on the whole of the entire game that she played, not just with, you know, scoring that fantastic goal that's certainly going to make her a household name in the women's game. But I think the United States rightful champions in this one. And unlike previous tournaments, we talked about this a little bit with our preview pod that we did, Rachel, about just the quality of the opponents and how the U.S. was going to have to go through the gambit. You know, normally in past iterations of the tournament, you know, it's not really until the semifinal or certainly the final that the U.S. plays, you know, an opponent that's up to their level from a talent perspective on paper or really has to show their A game. And realistically, you know, they had moments where that was necessary in the game against Spain, and certainly they had to be on their end game, you know, from the quarterfinals on, France, England, and then the Netherlands in that order. A couple shaky moments, three games that were all very close, three games where the opponents outplayed them at times, but three games where, on the whole, I would say all of the possession and the chance creation stats showed that the U.S. was a better team. Visually, it showed the U.S. was a better team, and the U.S. deserved to win all three of those games and thus deserves the trophy.
Yeah, and I think to your earlier point, because I think you made a lot of really good points there, I mean, that game could have been 4-5-0, but I mean, Netherlands had a really good goalkeeper. She put on an absolute clinic. So the United States, they definitely controlled that whole game. It just, goalkeepers are there to make the saves, and Netherlands goalkeeper really did that. She was fantastic, and I hope she gets a pretty big pay increase. She got the golden glove, as we all know. And so, I mean, hats off to her. She had a great tournament, and I mean, that save against Julia Ertz, I could watch that day in and day out. But another point that I think you just made about Rose Lavelle, when she's healthy, and for her to come back and bounce back from leaving the match against England with what looked like a hamstring. I mean, we all saw her look at the medical staff and say, it's my hamstring, but she came back and she just absolutely obliterated the competition with the Netherlands. She's so good when she's healthy, and I hope that she can remain that way for club, for that victory tour. And another point too, I think, you know, Mewis has been one of those players that sometimes she's a starter, some consistency of being a starter, and then, you know, she's on the bench for Lindsey Horan, which, nothing against either player, it's the depth problem that every coach would love to have, and that Jill Ellis fortunately does get to have. You have so many good players, but only 10 field players get to be on the pitch, plus the goalkeeper. So you have this conundrum of who do I start? And I think Mewis, not only did she prove herself in the tournament, she proved herself in those warm-up games too. I think she scored twice against New Zealand. I think she scored another one at Red Bull Arena against Mexico. I could be wrong about that, but I mean, she really proved herself throughout the pre-tournament matches and throughout the competition, and I think she is a lock. But, you know, looking at this roster, her and Horan, like, by the time the next World Cup comes, those two are going to be starting together in the midfield, more than likely. It's just amazing to see all the depth on this team and how young the team is. Didn't get to see Sonnet a lot in this tournament, Emily Sonnet, but I think it was a smart decision for Jill Ellis to put Allie Krieger in for that experience, and I think she did a really, really good job. She answered the call. But like Sonnet's gonna be your right back, more than likely. Maybe at the Olympics, maybe in 2023. But it's amazing to see the depth. You had Mal Pugh on the bench. Just, there's so much that you can do with this team, and it's going to grow.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Two quick points that I want to make on the topic of us, you know, shedding praise for the U.S. midfielders. I think they definitely neutralized Sherita Spitz, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and then the goalkeeper for the Netherlands, who, you know, we both said was excellent, was Sari van Veenendaal. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly as well. I'll admit my Dutch is not, I barely speak any Dutch. The amount of Dutch that I speak is basically what Dutch words do I know that's the exact same as in English. But no, I agree with you, Rachel. Let's shift this to maybe, I think, a 30,000 foot view. Maybe some of this is my age, and certainly watching, you know, the 94 World Cup, you know, when I was in preschool, and then obviously by the time I actually understood the game on any level, then it was the 99 World Cup. And I think a lot of what we talked about in making comparisons to as far as the 2015 team and their journey on to winning a championship was in context of what the 99ers do. And if I'm thinking of the women's U.S. national team, Mount Rushmore, I think prior to this tournament, and certainly prior to 2015, you had to say that Brandi Chastain and Mia Hamm were absolutely on there. And I think they were the gold standard that any of the players on the 2015 team, or now the 2019 world cycle, and then going into 2023, had to look up to. If that was the bar that was set, that they were looking to break through that metaphorical glass ceiling and then raise the bar even higher. And now I think there's no doubt in my mind that the Carly Lloyds, the Megan Rapinoe, certainly Alex Morgan with her goal record as well. All three of those players deserve to be into it. And this was kind of a culmination for that older generation who got the U.S. back to where they believe they're supposed to be in 2015, and then followed that up, especially given what happened in the 2016 Olympics, followed that up in the 2019 World Cup. What does this mean in terms of the U.S. women, maybe that group that's getting phased out? And I know you mentioned, you know, Rose Lavelle, the Mallory Pughes, the other generation's young talent that maybe wasn't fully bled out in this tournament. What does that mean as far as changing the guard in the ways that maybe we saw it in 1999 there, where there was a little bit of a drop off?
I think no matter what, you're always going to hear about the 99ers, and as you should. I just saw something the other day that they're doing. I don't know if it's a statue, but they're doing something. They're setting something up, I think, in San Francisco for them. But, I mean, you're always going to hear about them. But I think this team, we've heard it so many times, and it's really the truth. This team is like the tightest it's ever been, which is great. And it shows that on the field. I mean, they just are unstoppable. They will go and they will bulldoze their way through anyone. And you can truly see the camaraderie. I think, you know, I've read a lot of the books that players have written, whether it's Lloyd, Lombok, or Solo. And, you know, they're blunt and they're honest about it. There's been division before, but I don't see that with this team or anything. Your legends from this World Cup are absolutely your Alex Morgan, your Rose Lavelle, and honestly, I'd say Alyssa Nair, because she really stood up and answered. You're always going to hear Hope Solo's name. You're going to hear it at the Olympics, a lot next year, because that's kind of where Solo fell off of the U.S. national team train after the Cowards comment to Sweden, which, by the way, loved seeing her kiss up to them at the World Cup. But I mean, Alyssa Nair really rose up to the call. She's not a perfect goalkeeper. I'm a pretty harsh critic of her, and I think it's well known of that. But she impressed me because of how resilient she was throughout this tournament. And one of the things that she said that really, really made me start to like her is whenever they asked her, you know, when somebody's lined up for a penalty kick, what do you think? And she said, nothing. I just go there and I do my job. So I think those are your big three. And then, of course, Rapinoe, you got to throw her in there. She really answered the call. She had a lot going on in this tournament, as we know, the little political fight. Can't even say little. The political fight she had going on with the president. And she responded by winning the Golden Boot, the Golden Ball, and lifting a World Cup trophy. So I think this team is just so incredibly good. We're going to be talking about them for years and years to come. But now we need to focus the attention on, this is a great team and everything, but let's make it a great league. Let's make the U.S. a place where women's soccer should be known.
No, absolutely. I want to bring up a couple of other points on that. You know, talking about the U.S. women's national team being villains, and there was a writer who normally covers the Premier League in season, but then also does a lot of work, I guess, with the women's Premier League. I know he wrote a few things on Carly Lloyd when she was with Manchester City's women's team. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Rachel. And, you know, he basically said that, you know, the, like, the U.S. women's national team, they're hated in the context of greater women's soccer because they're the first national team from the United States to impose their U.S. dominance on a truly global game. You know, yes, we can talk about the dream team and everything that USA basketball has done in the Olympics and everything, but that's a game that the U.S. invented that's still the overwhelming majority of the best players in the world play are Americans and then play in the United States. You know, take any one of the guys from the last Olympic team on the U.S. and really put them on any team besides Argentina, who had Manu Ginobili, I believe, and then Spain, who I believe had Tony Parker, and then the Casal brothers, they'd be the best player by far. And we could say the same thing about, you know, the various track and field sports. Obviously, there's a little bit of debate there in hockey, but we could say the same thing of Canada. But this is the first, you know, real, like, USA us chanting as, you know, the United States men, a team of, you know, freakish all-stars, you know, defeat, you know, their equivalent of Thailand, like 140-14 or something, and the U.S. women did that in a truly global game and have now established what I would say fairly is a dynasty from these past two World Cups, and they're not really liked, and there was a lot of hubbub about what they did in the Thailand game, you know, despite all the men in various soccer tournaments around the world who like to take off their shirts or grab certain parts of their body. God forbid Alex Morgan wants to sip a little bit of tea in that moment. And then obviously you had some of the celebrations where some of the photos of which, you know, were maybe not well taken and I would say borderline hated. But, you know, to your point about this team being a dynasty, Rachel, and about, you know, this being the next generations, and yeah, they're still going to be compared to the 99ers, but now I think the 99ers have company, whereas I think 20 years from now, we could equally look at that next U.S. women's national team, you know, for like the, I'd have to check the math here, but, you know, like, I'm thinking like a 2046 World Cup or something, and we're trying to draw parallels or compare them from an expectation standpoint from, you know, we'll say collectively the generation that made the 2015 and the 2019 World Cup happen. So we can throw Hope Solo, we can throw Abby Wan back into that group that we've talked about for this tournament. I think we could equally compare that future generations group to this team and that generation as much as we could the 99ers as well. And I think in that, I think the bar is definitely set down. I think this is definitely a dynasty, and dynasties inevitably fall. So I guess on that note, let's talk about where women's soccer as a whole is headed, Rachel, because we've seen that there's been an increase in funding and opportunities for players, particularly in some of the European countries, obviously England and the Scandinavians and France, especially with Lyon, you know, are is it Lyon or is it Nice? I can't remember. The one that has the four-time Lyon. Thank you. Yes, I'm not up to date on my Ligue 1 clubs, let alone on the women's side of the game. So, you know, that money is certainly coming in. We've obviously seen the NWSL balloon, and certainly your coverage of that has, you know, been consistent as that league has continued to grow. I guess, where is the women's game as a whole going? And I know in the context of, you know, the last couple of World Cups, it was basically the U.S., one other team, and then a handful of other hopefuls. This was the deepest World Cup in the history, women's World Cup in the history of the tournament. And it is only going to get harder and harder from now going forward for the women to maintain their mantle. Yes, a bunch of teams came at the Queen, and, you know, you come at the Queen, you best not miss, and everybody missed, and, you know, everybody celebrating, you know, but where's the game as a whole going, and how do the U.S. women continue to maintain their dominance on the international and club level?
Well, I think to start out with that, first I have to say, I'm sure he's going to listen to this, but I'm sorry, Dan Sperry, for what I'm about to say. You have all of these videos showing these extravagant, crazy, probably 10,000 fans in Kansas City, everyone calling them the soccer capital, the women's soccer capital. FC Kansas City folded last year, and it was due to a lot of things, but one of them being extremely low attendance. So you've got all of these people coming out supporting the U.S. national team, which is fantastic, but they're not coming up in New York that are going to be at this parade on Wednesday. How many people have actually gone to a Sky Blue FC game? Listen, it sucks that there's only 9 teams in the league and they're in such different parts. From Pittsburgh, my closest team is the Washington Spirit, and that's 4 hours away from me. It stinks. It's not fun. People in Kansas right now, closest team, I believe, is the Houston Dash. So it's not the most accessible league. It's not like MLS where you basically have almost a team in at least 5 teams in the region, if I'm right here. It's not fun to have to be so far away from the action. But the people that are in those cities, they have to go out and support. If they really care about women's soccer like they say they do, like they're posting how they do, they need to get out to these games. The Reign are already selling out their stadium left and right, saying that they have to do standing room. I think now is a great time for more men's teams to work together with the women's teams. I mean, it's not, and it doesn't just have to be on an MLS basis. North Carolina FC of the USL Championship do a great job partnering with North Carolina Courage. It's not rocket science, really. I think there is a deal somewhere that I think Sky Blue is supposed to play a couple games at Red Bull Arena, but I'm not sure about that. It's just, there needs to be more of a partnership to grow the game. I think U.S. soccer needs to do more. I think the players do well at promoting their league. I saw a bunch of players tweeting out the last couple of days, yeah, great, we won the World Cup, now come support us. One thing that they agreed to do is shorten the victory tour. They usually did 10 victory tour matches. Now they're only doing, I think, 5 or 6 because they want to help grow the NWSL and they don't want to be taken from their clubs all the time. But, I mean, the first victory tour game was scheduled on an NWSL weekend, so that's a big uh-oh by the federation and the league or whoever wants to point fingers at. But still, I mean, it's baby steps towards it, but I think right now you have to build off the success of a World Cup. This, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this, I think, was the most talked about World Cup because of how high the competition was, all the craziness surrounding whatever team. I mean, of course you're going to get people talking about the Trump-Rapinoe thing. Just there were so many eyeballs on this tournament, and now it's time to build off that success. And it's not just U.S. national team players in the league. There are players that don't even get called up to a national team that are worthy of being watched by a bunch of fans and being praised by a bunch of fans. There, I could give you a list of players right now that I think should have been called up to the national team at some point, but haven't. And the national team players that aren't from the United States, there's great quality. The league has so much good quality, and it's just so important to grow that, because if it doesn't grow, then you're going to get more teams folding, which means no expansion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last couple of questions we'll get to here, Rachel, and then we'll move on to less fun things with the Gold Cup. But first, I guess on that note, as someone who is in Colorado, and the closest team I have geographically in the NWSL are...
The women are the Royals and the men are the Monarchs.
Yes, Royals. Thank you, Rachel. So in any case, I don't necessarily want to go watch them because they're associated with Real Salt Lake and all things bad and horrible on the Rockies side. If I wanted to watch an NWSL game on my computer, how would I go about doing that?
So the league actually partnered up with ESPN outlets for 14 games because their TV deal with A&E Networks kind of went kaboom. So there's going to be, I think, 8 games on ESPN News and 6 on ESPN2, which includes the championship and the playoffs. But all the other matches that aren't aired on ESPN are going to be aired on Yahoo Sports, which they've done a commendable job with what little I'm sure that they are given from the league in terms of resources and stuff. But, I mean, it's great quality, so be sure to watch it. If you live in one of those markets and can't make it to a match, be sure to watch it. Just help grow the women's game.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Rachel, last thing I'm going to ask you. We've obviously talked a lot about the U.S. Women's National Team on this podcast, and obviously they were one of the main focuses of the tournament as a whole. I want us each to pick two storylines, not U.S. Women-related, not related to the final itself, that we think were big things or something that we noticed, or maybe other storylines that we'd like to highlight. I'll let you go first.
I think first and foremost for me, Marta's speech after Brazil was knocked out of, what was it? It was not the quarter. Yes, it was the quarterfinals. I think it was the quarterfinals. No, the one before the quarterfinals. Whatever. But Marta's speech at the end of that match, I mean, smile or cry at the beginning so you can smile at the end, something like that. It was just so impassioned. And you can just tell that she wasn't just speaking to the Brazilian Federation. She was speaking to everyone who is involved with women's soccer. And I mean, listen, Abby Wambach might have that record for scoring goals, but to me, Marta is the greatest women's soccer player. Definitely the greatest striker to ever play the game. And she has done so much for that Brazilian Federation. Really crossing my fingers that they're at the Olympics. And if there was a team that wasn't the United States to win the World Cup for me, I would have wanted Brazil to win because Marta is the GOAT for me. Another good storyline. I enjoyed watching the first time teams. I really enjoyed watching Chile. Who else was a first timer? Italy wasn't a first timer, but watching their resurgence was really, really cool to see. That shows what happens when you put money into your, domestic federations into your national team. Argentina was another resurgence team. Seeing a lot of these really young teams just come out and really kind of bolster the competition. Of course, from CONCACAF, we have Jamaica and then we have South Africa. Great teams just coming out and giving it their all. And you know, Jamaica, they didn't win a match. They didn't draw a match, but every match that they played, it had so much passion in it. And then when Havana Solon scored that first ever Jamaican goal at a World Cup, you can just see the pride. I mean, we all saw the Thailand goal too. There were just so many great moments for new teams and teams that people just didn't really hear of.
No, well put. You took a couple of the ones that I wanted to use. You know, I'll point out, I think the final eight, which would have been the quarterfinals, the round after the round of 16, Rachel. You know, it was the United States and it was seven European teams. And it was seven European teams that, for the most part, are from countries where there is a women's league and where that women's league has progressed and grown in the number of teams, in the quality of facilities, in the sponsorships and the money being poured into the game, both by the actual clubs and by the federation and other sponsorship opportunities that they've had. You know, we highlighted what England as a country has done for the women's game and obviously Manchester City. You know, France obviously is up there as well. The Scandinavian countries, you know, have been, I think, a pleasant surprise in terms of what they've had. You know, we talked on, this might have been a couple of years, Rachel, years ago, where we were talking about how Sweden was the place to be as far as women's club soccer was concerned. And I think this, you know, it's a pretty obvious, you know, marker in terms of if you provide the facilities, if you provide the elite coaching, if you build the infrastructure and give space for the game to exist, and then players go there and then are given time to progress and improve, that they will progress and improve. And maybe the women's game isn't lesser than the men's game in terms of quality or in terms of interest, not necessarily because women are less bad, are not as good athletes as the men are, but simply because they haven't been given the same number of opportunities, financial infrastructure, personnel, etc. And surprise, you give that to them and they're going to be better. The Swedish national team was better than they were in the 2015 World Cup, and I would say better than what they were in the 2016 Olympics. I think this is the best England team that has ever existed on a major international tournament. I'd say similar things of the Dutch as well. And, you know, Germany's also improved as well, albeit in a country that I think is leading in terms of youth development and infrastructure. You know, they've just applied a lot of what they applied and realized was working in the men's game at the club level and the national team level. They just applied to the women's game, and that has also been extremely effective. So, you know, to the, you know, pointing out the obvious South American countries that have been lacking, ones that I would say Marta definitely subtweeted in her walk-off speech after the round of 16 loss for Brazil. You know, the countries that are going to continue to invest and provide opportunities for women, they're going to grow and they're going to be better on the women's stage, and the ones that don't are going to fall far behind. And part of why the U.S. women's national team has consistently been really good in this account is because I know there's issues with the equal pay, but in terms of, you know, doing power rankings in terms of what a soccer federation does and the opportunities they provide for men and the opportunities that they provide for women, and you top that off with, you know, everything that Title IX has done as far as being a, you know, a surrogate, or not a surrogate, what's I'm thinking of, a supplement for a women's league or for youth development has been fantastic at the college level. And other countries are starting to figure that out and putting in money, and they're, you know, there were teams that were at their best ever in 2019. They're going to be even better next year in the Olympics, and even better, you know, 4 years from now in the 2023 World Cup. So that's something I wanted to highlight. And the other thing, I don't know if this got fixed, Rachel, or if this was something that you noticed, but the right before the tournament, the change to PKs as far as like goalkeepers having to stand on the line, and then that being called very, very strictly in ways that it's almost never called in any other tournament at any other level, and that happening and being very confusing, especially in the group stage game. I think, you know, that was the turf, you know, that was the Sydney LaRue, turf bruises of this World Cup, in terms of just maybe, I hesitate to use the word shafted as an extreme standpoint, but just, you know, sidelining or saddling women with that thing when they could have implemented it later, they could have implemented it earlier, you know, they would like, you know, if there was a men's World Cup game being played on turf, people would be up in arms, and like there would be invasions and stuff that would be burned down. I think similarly, if there was that drastic of a change going into a men's World Cup on PK rules or changing the goalkeepers having to stand on the line, or if VAR was used for the first time in a men's World Cup, people would be absolutely up in arms, and nobody was really talking about it. I think they resolved it, or there weren't any crazy situations where that came into play, but I'd like to see FIFA do a little bit of a better job when they are implementing rules, do it in a way that's gradual such that it doesn't catch a whole bunch of elite athletes surprised, especially in a major tournament. Any other World Cup stuff we want to talk about, Rachel, or shall we head to the not fun Sunday stuff?
It was a fun month. It is over. Bring on the Olympics. And the Victory Tour, because the Victory Tour game is on my birthday, so hey, come to Pittsburgh.
Okay, Victory Tour game in Pittsburgh. But in any case, now, listeners, let's head forth to the nightcap on Super Soccer Sunday. This was after Brazil defeated Peru by a score of 3-1, I believe, in the Copa America final at the Maracanã. And that was the United States men's national team playing El Tri, Mexico, at Soldier Field in Chicago, Illinois, and the United States men were defeated. It was a 73rd minute goal by Jonathan Dos Santos, assisted by Raul Jimenez. U.S. national team definitely better, I would say, certainly in the opening 20 minutes and definitely in the whole of the opening 30 minutes. Paul Areola had a really good look just minutes in, and then the one that I think everybody's going to be talking about and is going to be burned into everyone's mind's eye for, you know, years to come is going to be Jozy Altidore's flub on an opportunity he got in the 8th minute off of a long cross from Tim Ream. He kind of ducks between the center backs and then pulls to try and create an angle on Guillermo Ochoa, and then just puts the ball 2 feet at the most, maybe wide of the near side post. The U.S. get a couple of other half chances. Mexico doesn't really have anything going for them. And then Tata Martino completely outcoaches Greg Berhalter in the second half with some of his tactical adjustments, with his substitutions. That leads to a goal for Jonathan Dos Santos. And the U.S. didn't really have anything going for them outside of really set pieces in the second half, especially in those final 20 minutes after Mexico went up 1-0. Rachel, your initial reactions to the match and Mexico being champions of CONCACAF?
So I think the last time we talked on this show or somewhere else, maybe just off the grid, we had talked about how that there's no giants in this tournament, that, you know, both teams have changed so drastically under their new head coach. But I mean, Mexico, they still found a way to get on top. And kudos to them. They had a really good Gold Cup, and that was a really good performance. I think it was an entertaining game. I don't think it was a heartbreak loss for the United States. There were a lot of really good positives in this tournament. A lot of good stuff to take away from it, good stuff to go into qualifying with, and a good look at who you want on that roster. There were some players, I think, that played themselves out of a roster spot. I think there were players that really brought themselves up more in the rankings and in Berhalter's system. But I think overall, really was disappointed in Jozy Altidore for not putting that attempt away. I was impressed with Weston McKennie for just showing all sorts of leadership and not being afraid to speak up in a, not a major tournament, but a tournament nonetheless that is important to United States fans, and in a rivalry game like Mexico, he's not afraid of the competition, which is awesome to see. Impressed a lot by Paul Arriola throughout the tournament. Defense, I have to give a lot of credit to Aaron Long. I thought he had a really, really good performance. I'm always a little strict on these MLS guys because I'm all about the European guys, but I think that he performed admirably well. Zach Steffen's going to keep that number one spot. A lot of positives, but I mean, it coming up short, it stinks, but second place is better than fourth, sixth, eighth, and not making it to the knockout round. So could have been better, could have been worse.
Yeah, no, really well said, Rachel. Let's talk about the CONCACAFing, because in this game you had a neutral official in the form of Mario Escobar. I believe it was a Costa Rican reffing crew, and you had no yellow cards the entire game. Not one player was actually put into the book. You had a couple really, really harsh fouls for my money in the first half that were just given as fouls. You know, I think Jozy Altidore around the 20th minute. I think Pulisic gave one out and then also got one as well. You had Andres Guardado, who was kind of a pest all night on both sides of the ball and almost took over the obligatory Rafa Marquez role in terms of CONCACAFing, Rachel. And then obviously, you know, just 2 minutes into that second half, you had the foul. I believe, I don't remember who it was who made it initially, but then Jozy Altidore goes down. The player falls on top of Jozy and then like pushes his head into the grass in order to get himself up, which it's really hard for me to believe that that wasn't deliberate or he didn't completely know what he was doing at that point. Weston McKennie immediately shows up and tries to pull him up. Andres Guardado shows up, and, you know, I know there was no VAR in this game, and, you know, okay, if somebody grabs somebody's throat and the referee is looking the other way from 30 yards away, I can understand him not seeing, but the ref immediately goes to try and break up McKennie and Guardado, the two captains, arguing over stuff, and Guardado puts his hand in a chokehold around Weston McKennie in that entire sequence. Eventually, the officials break everything up and they get them to separate their own ways, and the foul was called for the original, you know, pushing of Jozy that caused him to go to the ground. No yellow cards in that entire sequence. And I has, you know, so much of how teams have to have success in CONCACAF, whether it's a Gold Cup, World Cup qualifying, is really just being composed when one of those weird plays doesn't go your way, or when you are getting out gamesmanshipped by the opponent and it just completely gets under your skin and is like at the point of almost gaslighting you. And in that, I feel like the Mexicans had their composure when they were getting severely outplayed in the opening 30 minutes. And then they came out and were super, super chippy. The U.S. were already frustrated for not being up a goal, and that frustrated them in the game and allowed Mexico to get back into the match. Like, am I crazy here, Rachel? Like, should this game have finished like 10-9?
You're not crazy. I mean, we're all crazy because we're national team fans, but I mean, you're not crazy. That was CONCACAFing at its finest. I mean, just, the chokehold. I can't. The chokehold. So bad. They just need to do better. I mean, if you want to be seen as a legitimate tournament, you want to be seen as a legitimate federation. What is the word I'm looking for? Grouping, whatever, I'll go with grouping, then you need to get better referees, you need to train them better, and you need to address things like this. I don't think it's even been addressed yet. Yeah, I don't know. It's so bad. CONCACAFing, everyone. I hate it.
No, absolutely. Let's talk about second half decisions and maybe what this means for where the U.S. national team are at. You know, you had the substitutions for Mexico. Carlos Rodriguez comes in for Rodolfo Pizarro. We talked about some of the adjustments that Mexico made that I thought Tata Martino was absolutely brilliant in terms of realizing what wasn't working and getting things to work. And you had Christian Roldan on for Jordan Morris. Neither of them were particularly impressive for me, Rachel. I texted with a couple of my friends who are American Outlaws, where the moment one of them is an extreme fatalist and an absolute Jossie Zardes hater, but as soon as 64th minute came, Jozy Altidore out for Jossie Zardes in, I texted him and said, we're losing this game 1-0. And then you had Daniel Lovitz on for Tim Ream, you know, no Jordi Mihailovic in the second half, no Nick Lima in the second half, and the big one that I think everybody's certainly talking about is a Tyler Boyd. Did Greg Berhalter get out coach in the second half, and what is this result?
He most certainly did. Sorry, you cut out on here for
go
a minute.
For it.
He got so outcoached. I mean, the subs just didn't really make any sense. Despite being Sounders teammates, Christian Roldan and Jordan Morris are not like for like subs. They play two very different positions. I know that Jordan plays a little bit more off, Christian plays a little more in the back. So putting them on for each other is a little iffy, in my opinion. I wouldn't have mind Jordi Mihailovic going in for Jordan Morris. I wouldn't have mind Tyler Boyd, although I am assuming Tyler Boyd somehow has a knock or something. God, Jossie is Jossie. I don't even know what more to say about him. What hasn't been said? First off, mad at you for cursing us for the 1-0 comment. I had no idea you did that. But I mean, when Jossie Zardes goes into a game, you just don't know what to expect. Sometimes he's great, sometimes he's not. But he's one of those players that is, when he's good, he's great, but when he's bad, he is like so god-awful bad. And, he was that god-awful bad. Didn't really care for the Daniel Lovitz, switch. Not just because you and I are officially the president and vice president of the Tim Ream hype club, but, I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I don't think that goal was really much of either Tim Ream or, Reggie Cannon's fault. I think just the center backs were kind of split out a little too far, and the defensive midfielders were relied on a little too much on that play, and he just, like, from what I saw, Who scored that for Mexico again?
Jonathan Dos Santos.
Yeah, Jonathan Dos Santos pretty much had an open lane. That backheel pass just threw everyone off. So I didn't really understand the sub. If I'm Greg Berhalter and we're in the 82nd minute and we're losing 1-0 and there's a chance to have that wonder goal and get back in it, I'm putting in an attacking player. I'm not really focusing too much on the defense, except for maybe telling Michael Bradley to drop back a little bit more. So yeah, I think he got outcoached for sure by Tata, and it'll just be interesting to see what happens. Somebody said that it was announced that we're playing Mexico in a friendly in September. So I mean, we'll see what happens. I assume that's going to be a FIFA window game. So.
Yeah, no. Okay, Rachel, let's do a similar thing that we did for the Women's World Cup. I want you to pick some narrative or statement or conclusion or hot take you could make about the men's national team. It could be related to the final or the tournament as a whole. It could be a, this player needs to never get called in again. You know, this tactical thing was something that was good or something that was bad. And then one other comment, non-final, non-US related, about the tournament as a whole. So that could be about Curaçao. That could be about, you know, the aging core being pretty much done for Costa Rica. Give me one big takeaway that you have for the United States, and then one big takeaway you have for somebody else from the Gold Cup as a whole.
Like I said earlier, for the U.S. men, I was really impressed with Aaron Long, but I think I was really impressed with how well he fit into Berhalter's system. He's a center back by trade, of course, and he was slotted right there. I do like the formation that Greg is working with an almost like three center back formation. And a lot of times it was Aaron Long, a mixture of Matt Miazga, Tim Ream, and, who am I missing? Walker Zimmerman. And I think it worked out pretty well. I mean, like I said, I'm a pretty harsh critic of these MLS guys. I don't think any one of those four guys are going to start over John Brooks whenever he gets healthy and gets back into the picture. But, I mean, it's a good start. And I wouldn't even mind seeing an Aaron Long, John Brooks partnership. I think, you know, obviously, I don't think Tim Reamer left back of the future. He's getting up there in age, but aside from that, I mean, he's got quality, but I don't think he is the best left back we can pull from. I think there's still a chance for maybe someone like Jorge Villafania or even, dare I say it, Fabian Johnson to get back into the picture somehow, some way. And I think we're also forgetting too, that right back side, you're going to have DeAndre Yedlin come back eventually soon, hopefully soon. So if I'm Greg and I know that DeAndre Yedlin's coming back, I feel like I have to look at Nick Lima and Reggie Cannon and pick between one of the two. And if I'm Greg, I'm picking Reggie Cannon because I think Nick Lima had a horrendous tournament. Something non-US men's national team related. Really enjoyed watching Eloy Room play for, how do you say it, Curaçao?
Curaçao.
Curaçao. And he was rewarded. As we know, he was signed by the Columbus. He should be joining them. I think he's officially on the roster today, pending the international and FIFA paperwork and whatnot. But he was rewarded for his efforts, and I think Columbus really needs somebody like him right now. Joe Bendick is not your starter, I can tell you that right now. So to see players like that get on an international stage and get a little bit of exposure, I think it's a great thing to see.
No, well said, Rachel. I'm just going to simply put it, for the U.S. as a whole, I think progress was made. I think we saw individuals make progress in the context of the system and in context of establishing themselves as being an option for Greg Berhalter, whether or not they're a starter. You know, I think more data points are needed on that front. And I think for all of the doom and gloom that I think still has been, you know, diffusing out from, you know, that dark October evening, in Trinidad and Tobago 2 years ago, I think the U.S. aren't as far away from Mexico as I think people maybe thought. You know, they arguably could have, it could have been the 10th minute of the final on Sunday and the U.S. could have been up 2-0. And then I think we're talking about a very different result and we're having a very different conversation, about this team right now on Tuesday night. Obviously, the major moment of a single moment of brilliant quality was not there for the U.S. Josy Altidore didn't have it. Giassi Zardes didn't have it. Jonathan Dos Santos, of all players, had it. You know, he has 3 goals this calendar year for Mexico, Rachel. He's first call-up for El Tri at the senior level was 2009. He had 0 goals going into 2019 at the senior level, all competition, which is kind of surprising. But, you know, Mexico was missing a bunch of big players, but the U.S. was also missing a couple of other players. I think, you know, everybody healthy and everybody being fit, I think Tim Weah has a significant role in this team, and we did not see him in this tournament. Definitely would say the same things of Tyler Adams. And I think a lot of the criticisms are what people are casting as blame against Michael Bradley for being older, for being slower, or not being able to work in the system. I think really was those were all weaknesses or faults that could have been covered up by Tyler Adams, both in a right back position or in a central midfield role alongside Weston McKennie or Michael Bradley, or maybe one of them comes off the bench. And we could argue about that for an hour and not really get anywhere close to it. And I could argue about it with an hour for Greg Berhalter, and this is probably something that he does when he's not sleeping at 4 in the morning every single day. So the U.S. were missing some key players. Mexico was obviously missing some key players, but the fact is everybody was all doom and gloom. They thought if the U.S. got one bad result, they weren't going to get out of the group, and you know, they took care of business against Trinidad and Tobago. They had some struggles against Curaçao, who I would think outside of the big three were the most impressive team, of this entire tournament. They took care of business against Jamaica, unlike in 2015 against a very good Jamaica side. And like, they were one bounce away from going extra time against Mexico. And if they finish their chances in that one, you know, they win that game. I don't, you know, the team is not as bad as I think everybody wanted to put them under. And I don't think the team is as good as if we were heaping praise on them if they had somehow managed to beat Mexico by a, you know, let's say anywhere within a 2-goal margin for this. So in that, progress was made. The U.S. is not where they want to be. It's not where Greg Berhalter wants them to be, but They've got, you know, 3 more years in order to figure it out, and there's going to be a lot more progress made on that front, and a lot of other players who are going to get incorporated in the team. And every single player, both the ones who were on this team and the ones who were just out for injuries or for other reasons, I think especially the European-based ones, are in pending Christian Pulisic, just because I think Chelsea could be an absolute dumpster fire this year, you know, are in good positions going into their 2019-2020 European club seasons, and that puts them, I think, in a great pace for the team going into World Cup qualifying, you know, 14-ish months from now. All right, Rachel, let's head to the round table. We're just doing pick-ems because we had so much international soccer to talk about. So we'll start on Friday, Rachel. This will all be MLS-based stuff. We got the Cali Clasico, LA Galaxy hosting San Jose Earthquakes. What's the score line?
I'm going to go with San Jose with the 2-1 score line.
Okay.
Just because I think I'm psychotic.
Alrighty, I'm going to go 2-1, and this is purely going to be a Zlatan playing well game. And I think Jonathan Dos Santos and Uriel Antuna being back with the LA Galaxy is going to be a big boost for them. And then also on Friday, this will be at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, you got the 4-1 Derby, Montreal Impact hosting Toronto FC. What do you got, Rachel?
I think Jozy Altidore is going to really want to come back and score a ton of goals because of that horrendous final performance. Michael Bradley, of course, he's going to be that stalwart in the midfield. So I'm going to say 3-1 Toronto.
I'll take 3-2 Toronto, and the game finishes 10-10 because 4-1 Derby, hashtag Team Chaos. And then moving on to the Sunday games, Rachel, we've got Seattle Sounders hosting Atlanta United. This will be, I don't know if this is a weird timing thing or if it's like the broadcast or something, but it's listed at 3:55 p.m. Eastern as a kickoff. So I guess right around 4, it might be 3:30. I'm not sure, folks. In any case, Seattle hosting Atlanta. What do you got, Rachel?
You know what I got for this one. We're going to go 2-1 Seattle. I don't think it's going to be a blowout. Joseph Martinez, obviously, being there for Atlanta helps. When I was in Columbus, I was talking to Brian Schmetzer about the center back duo, because for the last year and a half, it's been Chad Marshall, Kim Keehy, and now they're kind of switching everything around. So I don't think it's going to be a clean sheet yet, because I still think they're getting used to that. I mean, come on, go Sounders.
I'll take 2-1 to Seattle on this one. I'll say Raul Ruiz Diaz brace will be back from his time in Copa America. And then lastly, this will be the nightcap on Sunday. We got Hudson River Derby at Red Bull Arena. New York Red Bulls hosting New York City FC. This will be at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. Rachel, who you got and why?
Red Bulls getting Aaron Long back is going to be huge for them. And I think that is going to give them enough to give them a boost ahead. I think it's going to be tight, but let's go 1-0.
Okay, I'll go 2-0 to the Red Bulls in this one. They had a fantastic result at Atlanta. Old man Bradley Wright Phillips coming off the bench to make it 3-3 in that one. Aaron Long's going to be back with the team. They figured a couple things out, and NYCFC didn't really look impressive in their DGW last week, including a 1-0 loss at home to the Portland Timbers. So I'll take 2-0 in this one, but I'll say the second goal will be late in the game, you know, like 85th minute or maybe even stoppage time, and NYCFC is just throwing numbers forward, and in trying to get back into the game, they will risk giving up a second one, and the New York Red Bulls will get one on the counter, and so it'll be 2-0 in the Hudson River Derby. That does it for us with all of our big stuff we got going on, Rachel. Where can people find you on Twitter, and do you have any last words?
Find me on Twitter at Rachel McCrigger, 2 A's, not just one. Any last words? Congrats to the U.S. Women's National Team. Can't wait to see what they do at the Olympics. Can't wait to see the other teams that are going to be added to the Olympics. It's going to be a really fun next year of women's soccer victory tour, Olympics, She Believes Cup, all kinds of stuff. It's going to be a lot of fun. And of course, I mean, NWSL, so get out and support your local club.
Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWS Matt Pollard, lastwordonsoccer.com, at lastwordsc across all social media platforms. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Just search LWS Radio or Last Word. Thank you to our sponsors. First, Golden Go Press, the best choice for you to get custom shirts, hats, or mugs or other items for yourself or your organization. Check out their amazing products at a fraction of the price at other places at goldengoldpress.com. And thank you also to Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier for MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or your team at roughneckscarves.com. They also have a fantastic selection of US Women's National Team stuff. If you are late to the party and want to get on that bandwagon and swag for the victory tour or the parade or upcoming NWSL games that you plan on attending, as Rachel has urged us all to do. My last word that I've got for tonight, Rachel, I know we just got done with like the craziest month of soccer, you know, in I would say years, at least for me, with the three tournaments going on simultaneously here at Last Word. But you've got the U.S. Open Cup that is in the quarterfinals of this coming week. Most of the games are on Wednesday. That's July the 10th, folks. And we've still got two non-MLS teams that are in the tournament. St. Louis FC is at Atlanta United, and then New Mexico United is taking on Minnesota. Two MLS teams that have some big MLS games coming up and might be prioritizing league play and making the playoffs over the actual over the cup competition itself. So two real opportunities post FC Cincinnati for a potential USL team to make it to the semifinal. That would be huge, and a bunch of other really good MLS teams as well. All right, that does it for us, folks. We'll see you next time.